Green Sense Radio is brought to you by Green Sense Farms. We're changing the world with sustainable indoor vertical farming, growing more with less. Our leafy greens are sold live so they burst with flavor. Visit greensensefarms.com and watch us grow.
Welcome to Green Sense, a weekly look at the people, policies, and innovations that are changing our world. Here's Robert Colangelo.
Thanks for joining us. I'm your host for the show.
And this is executive producer Bob Kessler. This week, Robert, we head over to the Museum of Water, which is something that's a traveling exhibit throughout the UK. Curator Amy Shirox will tell us more. And it's a good idea to move over to renewable energy for a lot of reasons. One of them is it's just better for people's health. We'll find out about a new study.
All coming up on this week's edition of Green Sense. There's a lot of talk when it comes to global water issues. The challenge is to get people inspired to take action so that they could change their behaviors so that they improve water management practices. The Museum of Water, a traveling exhibit that started 5 years ago, is curated by Amy Shirox. Amy joins us all the way from the UK right now on Green Sense. Welcome, Amy.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us. And you run a very interesting museum. You're a live artist. So explain what the museum consists of and how you came up with the idea.
So in 2013, I began Museum of Water, which is a collection of water, any water in any bottle given to me by members of the public. So it invites you to think about the water in your as it flows through, as it touches your lives, you know, what you like about it. It invites you to spend time with it, to really consider it, and then just bring a little bit of it and tell me what you like about it.
Well, what was the reason for creating a traveling museum rather than a static one?
After 2 years of gathering water across Britain, I had an extraordinary collection of 400 or 500 bottles of water, all different shapes and sizes, all treasuring a different kind of water. And I was invited to make Museum of Water in the Netherlands. And we faced the possibility I could have just brought the water I already had and treated it like so much sculpture and shipped it over and said, look at what I've got. But I felt, and the incredible Rotterdamse Schouwburg that I was working with, we all talked about it, and it just didn't make so much sense that this piece depends entirely on people to bring things, that it is a piece about being here now. It is our experience of water here, not last year's, not the year before, but what it's like for you that it makes this piece relevant and crucial. So we built a whole new collection for the Netherlands. And for last year, for the last 2 years, I've been traveling around Western Australia, building an Australian collection.
Well, the Netherlands is a perfect place. They have a large portion of the country is underwater, and they're some of the best water engineers. So I'm sure they were happy to have you there. You said you had 500 bottles of water. Where did the water come from? And why was it in bottles?
Well, so now I have 1,217 bottles of
water.
Wow. Just saying. So the water comes from all over the world. People have given me the first cup of tea of the day. They've given me the last bath at the end of the long day. They've given a girl scooped up the water from the walls of a nightclub after a night full of dancing. Another woman gave me her breaking waters and the water her baby was born into. The British Antarctic Survey gave me water from 19,600 years ago, from the very coldest part of the last ice age And they also gave me three tiny bottles from 129,000 years ago, from the last warm period in the Earth's history before the last ice age.
Well, that is quite a collection of water, and each has such a unique story. But what about the bottles? Are those unique, and do those have a story also?
Yeah. So this piece, this artwork, Museum of Water, invites you to bring any water in any bottle. So you make the piece, you know, you curate it, you choose what is in it and what carries the water. You are the co-creator of this piece. I just dust down the bottles sometimes. I remember your words. I remember what you say to me about the water in the bottle. So, but the bottles are absolutely crucial. You know, they are, you know, sometimes they're like the eight-year-old girl who gave me her melted snowman with these two small pink beads in for his eyes. She gave it in a little pesto jar because, and you realize, you know, that was what she had access to. It's what she eats. It tells as much about the story of her days as the water that's inside it.
One of the important things about art is it really stirs the spirit and it inspires people to take action. Our show is all about sustainability. So tell us, how has the museum inspired people to take action when it comes to water conservation or water management practices?
Alongside the museum, alongside the bottles themselves, everywhere we go, we have a wide cultural program for the serious investigation of water through everything that we can think of. I've spoken with water engineers, water chemists, water lawyers, scientists, priests, the music ethnographer from the Pitt Rivers Museum. You know, we have partnered with universities and societies and academics across the world. Every place that we go, we've taken people out to sea on surfboards in Australia to read the waves and to understand more about the ocean floor. We have, there was an extraordinary artist we worked with in Australia called Jen Jameson, who made a live artwork called How to Have a 3-Minute Shower. Which was so brilliant. So everyone, you know, got dressed down to their swimmers and all had a 3-minute shower. But this, but also that has more resonance when, you know, in the UK, we have 4-minute shower. You know, our Thames Water gives us 4-minute shower clocks. And in Cape Town, they were being urged to have 2.5-minute showers.
So well, we just did a story on Cape Town and their crisis. My guest is Museum of Water curator Amy Shirox, and we're talking about the Mobile Water Museum. So talk a little bit about Cape Town, because that is an issue that has gotten to dire situations for a large mass of people. What has the museum or the exhibit done to maybe help or inspire action there?
Well, I haven't been to Cape Town. I would love to go. One of the things that was really extraordinary about being in Perth this last time, Perth, Western Australia, the Minister for Water came and he brought water from their waste recycling water. Basically, they can turn human waste into drinkable water. And that is one, you know, in Perth, in Western Australia, it's 70% of their drinking water comes from desalination plants. And he told me the story of these cities on the southernmost tips of all the continents, so Cape Town, Perth, and South America, that actually the winds that used to bring the rains to those southern tips have changed, you know, due to global warming, so that now they don't get the rains that they used to get. Their rainfall has changed some incredible percentages. And that is what has brought these cities to these crises. But a woman came from Cape Town to Australia and brought a tiny bit of water in a little plastic bottle, you know, from her 50-liter ration a day. And she talked to us about what it was like living in Cape Town. And she said, now when it rains, and this was maybe two months ago now, she came into the museum. Everyone immediately burst into tears. You know, she'd been through so much. And she said that now, when it rains in Cape Town, everyone stops what they're doing. She said the last time it rained, she'd been in a Pilates class and everyone just walked outside and looked up at the sky and held their arms out.
Quite touching. Can you tell us another example of maybe one or two of the samples that are part of the museum that mean the most to you?
Oh, I don't have favorites, but I could tell you.
Well, pick one. But... You've got to have one favorite. Everybody does. Tell me one. Ooh. That really touches you.
Oh, I really don't. I have been I feel very strongly that I am the holder of so many people's moments of care. And I have a duty of care, which is, but there's so many brilliant, beautiful bottles I could talk about, but I'll tell you about one. There was a really lovely man up in Lancaster when we were in the north of England. And he said he came and he looked at our collection. He saw the trombone spit from a 16-year-old boy whose parents had brought it because they were so proud of him. He'd been playing jazz in this incredible music hall in London and they'd brought it down. He goes, oh, you've got trombone spit? And I said, yeah. And he goes, I'm in a 5-piece brass band. You know, we could come. And he came the next day with the whole band. And they played 7 songs for us in the museum, in the gallery, in this huge space that we were in. And as they played, they sat by their feet with 5 little jars. And at the end of the songs, they poured the condensation from all their instruments into a jar and gave it to the museum. So this sense of the museum as an instigating force for action, for care, for creativity, for gifts. This is a giving economy of care, and that's what I love about it.
Well, Amy, we really appreciate you being on Green Sense and sharing those stories, and we wish the museum best of luck, and we hope it comes to this side of the pond. And
thanks
collect some
much.
Samples here, and
thanks
we'd love
much.
To meet you.
Thanks very much. I'm coming on a site visit to Utah, Vancouver, and Toronto this year. So who knows?
Artist Amy Shorrocks telling us about the Museum of Water, which you can learn more about at museumofwater.co.uk. This is Robert Colangelo, and you're listening to Green Sense. Subscribe to our podcast when you visit greensensefarms.com.
Green Sense Radio is brought to you by Green Sense Farms. We're changing the world with our sustainable indoor vertical farming, growing more with less. Our leafy greens are sold live, so they burst with flavor. Visit greensensefarms.com and watch us grow.
Using cleaner sources of energy has both long-term and short-term benefits. One of those is the connection to alternative sources of energy with improved long-term health to humans. Here to tell us more about his ongoing research is geoscientist Scott Montgomery with the University of Washington's Jackson School of International Studies. Welcome, Dr. Montgomery.
Thank you very much. I'm very glad to be here.
Well, what's the global connection between fossil fuels and disease that your research has been working on?
Okay, there are two large connections that are fairly well known, actually, at least to those who study global health. One of them has to do with coal and with the particulate matter that comes out of coal. This is not just the pollutants that we normally hear about, but these are tiny particles, about 2.5 to 10 microns across, that that people breathe in many parts of the world. These are often trapped by electrostatic precipitators, as they're called, on coal plants. Excuse me again. that have pollution controls, but a large number of these plants don't have such controls, especially in developing countries. Now, the other one has to do with diesel fuel, which I know people don't like to have in their faces, but it also carries what are called secondary aerosols that are created particularly from sulfur dioxide that comes out of diesel fuel. And that particulate matter has the same impact on the lungs, the respiratory, and the circulatory system that the particulate matter from coal does. So both coal and diesel are very crucial and affect somewhere between 3 and 5 million premature deaths a year around the world. And this is not just in developing countries, it also extends to the U.S. and Canada and Europe.
We all know about coal. It's pretty prevalent and it's low cost. It works pretty much everywhere. But diesel, you know, here in the U.S., you just think about it as fueling trucks. How prevalent is diesel globally?
Yeah, it's an excellent question. And through the windshield of our cars, we usually think that the world runs on gasoline, but in fact, diesel runs a much larger array of vehicles, large array of trucks, everywhere from China to the U.S., and then, of course, the military equipment, and then a great deal of off-road equipment. Diesel is used a considerable amount more than gasoline is worldwide, and so it's a significant factor to pursue. I would say also that the fuel quality of diesel is highly variable. In Europe and the U.S., it has pretty low sulfur, but in large parts of the rest of the world, it's orders of magnitude higher, the sulfur content. So the fuel quality is much less. And in those countries, the health effect of diesel is much greater.
Well, we understand that hydrocarbons are used for feedstock to make many chemicals, including pesticides and fertilizers for agriculture, fuel to run engines. But you're also focusing on people using open fires for cooking. How much of a source of pollution and health problems are caused by burning wood and fossil fuels?
Yeah, so that's another very important question. Indoor air pollution tends to be worse than outdoor, or what the World Health Organization calls ambient air pollution. When you think of people who spend a lot of time indoors cooking and heating, you think mostly of women and girls and babies and perhaps the older generation. And this is exactly the demographics that are most affected by burning open fires. And these fires use wood. They also use animal dung. They use various kinds of vegetation. And they also use charcoal and coal when people can get it. And it's one thing for this material to be out in the open. It's quite another for it to be captured inside. And there are somewhere between 2.5 and 3 billion families around the world that make use of this kind of fuel, and the air pollution effects on their circulatory and their respiratory systems are particularly bad. There are a lot of attempts to try and cure that by various stoves and things, but those are really partial and temporary fixes for this. It's really a situation where you need a change in the type of fuels that people are using. It's also a political problem. I mean, this would liberate a lot of women from having to look for fuel and then burning it and then having shorter lifespans and more diseases at the same time.
My guest is Scott Montgomery with the University of Washington's Jackson School of International Studies, and we're talking about the impact of fossil fuels on human health. Scott, you mentioned these, lower, more available sources like wood, dung, and potentially diesel. You know, that's all cheap. It's readily available. How are you going to take these billions of people and get them onto cleaner, safer alternative fuel sources?
Yeah, well, that is the $64 trillion question, isn't it? That's something that I'm still researching. I'm really at an early phase in this research and writing. I intend to put a book together on this. There are a number of different possibilities that include renewable energy. And I should say that renewable energy, if we look at it from the view of a natural resource, which I think we should, we see that different countries have different resources. Some have solar resources, some have geothermal, some have oceanic and tidal, and some have wind. Very, very few have all of those. So the ability to harness those is quite variable. But I would also emphasize that we need to not focus purely on one group of sources. We really do need to focus on all the ones that could possibly be used to create sustainable electricity supply systems. And so I would also put nuclear power in that same category as a non-carbon source.
What about starting small? We've done some stories on solar ovens. You start small, get people off dung and wood and diesel, you get them solar ovens, and they start getting used to this. So you just as eliminating plastic straws from our cups, you multiply that by millions of people, you start to have some big change out there.
Well, you do and you don't. You have changes in terms of the fuel that people are using inside the houses, but you don't do anything about the water systems, which are the other great sources of diseases. You really need a sustainable and large-scale electricity supply system to take care of all of these different things in terms of sewage and water treatment and water recycling and piped water supply. So I see these things as all part of a very large, holistic kind of situation. And solar stoves are just not going to do it. There's another problem with some of these small scale solutions, and that is that people do get hooked on them in the sense that that's as far as things go. And governments sometimes tend to assume that the problem is taken care of and then leave it alone for a while. But what we're really talking about is bringing these people into the modern world of energy, but selectively, so that they don't suffer from the types of pollution that the Western world and other advanced countries did early on in the Industrial Revolution. So I'm looking at this at a much longer term problem with variable solutions.
So one area that this has lots of impact is China, which has a huge population problem and an increased demand for energy. Are there any positive signs that a country that large with that much demand for electricity is going to make that shift to alternative energy?
Well, there are definitely signs. The big question is will they be enough? So China is very rapidly scaling up a number of non-carbon and low-carbon sources. One of those is natural gas. They are building a lot of dams for hydropower and water supply. They are building by far the largest number of nuclear reactors every year. And they are also have scaled up their wind and solar facilities considerably. And so their overall coal use has declined slightly, but it is such an enormous, I should say, immense scale that to be able to use these other non-carbon and low-carbon sources to replace all of the coal use they do will take decades and decades. Xi Jinping, who now leads the Central Party in China, says that the maximum in emissions, carbon emissions, greenhouse gas emissions for China won't be reached until 2030. So the real question, as I'll return to here, is whether they're doing enough and whether it can be done fast enough to actually take care of the enormous public health problem that they've created in their breakneck industrialization.
Scott, we have time for one sentence in closing. Mm-hmm. What can you give us on a positive note?
The opportunities to improve people's health are enormous, and they've been enormous, and they've made enormous advancements since 1990. There are still things to be done, but at this point, what really needs to be used as a solution are energy advancements. Energy and health have an urgent bond for humanity, and I see that there need to be advances in both of those.
That's geoscientist Scott Montgomery with the University of Washington's Jackson School of International Studies talking about alternative energy as a key to long-term health. You're listening to Green Sense. Subscribe to our podcast when you visit greensensefarms.com. We hope you enjoyed this edition of Green Sense. Visit greensensefarms.com to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play, and you can check out the list of radio stations that air our show. All you have to do is stay fresh, keep innovating, because when you're green, you grow.
GreenSense Radio is brought to you by GreenSense Farms. We're changing the world with sustainable indoor vertical farming, growing more with less. Our leafy greens are sold live, so they burst with flavor. Visit greensensefarms.com and watch us grow.
GreenSense is recorded in the Duneland ecosystem on the eastern shores of Lake Michigan. The program is copyright GreenSense Farms, all rights reserved.